Hello, and welcome to the Psychedelic Psychiatrist Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the discussion around all aspects of psychedelic medicine. This is also a space that hosts conversations about impactful personal journeys and a way to decrease stigma around these molecules and share our experiences with one another. So get ready for some deep dives and fun times. I'm your host, Juan Pablo Galindo. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. So on today's episode, I'm excited to share with you the conversation that I had with Dr. Tori Olds, a clinical psychologist out of Austin, Texas. And she specializes in experiential therapy. But I found Dr. Olds on YouTube, of all things. Sometimes I'll go on YouTube and like search something on there in terms of like therapy or a phrase, and just kind of check out what other people are saying. As you know, on YouTube there can be a lot of varied quality of videos and topics, and especially with in the health and wellness section, there can be a lot of different videos. Some are helpful, some are not very helpful. But yeah, I fell on Tori Olds' page on YouTube and was really drawn to the way that how she explains things in her videos. And her videos are like so well done and so well made on a professional level. But like beyond that, the way that she presents the information and her presence, and the way that she talks about therapeutic modalities and therapeutic ideas really resonated with me. And so I reached out to her and asked her if she wanted to be on the podcast. And she was so cool about agreeing to come on and have a conversation with me where we talk about experiential therapies and define those and like why they work, and also tying them back into psychedelic therapies. And it was really cool talking with her and discovering how our modalities of the work that we do have so many overlaps and crossover. So it was fun experiencing that. And a little bit more background on Dr. Tori Olds is that she went to undergrad at Middlebury College, where she majored in modern dance and English. And then she went on to receive her PhD in counseling psychology from Texas A&M University. And it was really cool to learn that her family unit growing up and now around her are all therapists as well. And she jokes that she's fluent in therapy. And that's something that I really noticed from her YouTube videos. So when she told me that, it all made sense of why she's able to relay this work in such a cool and approachable way with a lot of passion and knowledge behind it. So yeah, without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Tori Olds. All right, so welcome, Tori, to the podcast. So excited to have you on with us today.
Thanks. So it's great to be here.
Yeah. So if you wouldn't mind kind of introducing yourself to the audience so we can have a better understanding of who you are and just kind of get to know you better.
Yeah. So my name's Dr. Tori Olds. What about me? I'm a therapist in private practice in Austin. I, along with my family, we may mention in a moment that everyone in my family is a therapist, literally everybody. So my sister and I, my husband, and both my parents a number of years ago started a clinic in Austin that's kind of spreading around Texas. We have 150 clinicians now. And I was in charge of doing a lot of the training, as we were beginning, had a ton of postdocs at once sometimes. And so I got really interested in training therapists, explaining therapy to, therapists actually love doing that with the lay population as well through my YouTube channel. I just love explaining psychology concepts. But it was wonderful mentoring, supervising, And then thinking about how to integrate different theories, especially in the experiential domain. So that's kind of been my focus, is now really more doing more teaching than even therapy, and, you know, helping a little bit with the clinic. And so that's who I am.
All right. Awesome. How's Austin, Texas this morning? How's it out there?
It's getting warm. It was cold for a moment, and now it's 80s.
All right. Awesome.
Already.
Yeah. I have a special place in my heart for Austin, Texas. My wife went to UT. And then, my brother's a singer-songwriter, and so he's played at South by Southwest a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. I'm a singer-songwriter too.
Yeah.
I mean, I just have folk music, but it's wonderful.
No, wonderful. Awesome. And so, like, what led you, I know it sounds like you were surrounded by therapists, like, your whole life, but, like, for you, like, what was kind of, like, the moment that, where you decided, like, I wanted to do this as my career, I want to pursue this, deeper, like, can you tell me about that?
I have a little bit of an unusual story with that, because it was so young, just because I was around so many therapists. And, you know, my parents were kind of leaders in the community in Austin, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, like hippies, you know, and all that, but also really, you know, studying therapy, doing a lot of group therapy training in particular. And they would just have wonderful trainers, people that were training them that had invented these different models, especially group therapy models. They would come to Austin and stay with us and, you know, to do training in the local community. And I just remember pretty young, I mean, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, loving sitting around the dining room table. I couldn't, you know, listening to them talk about psychology. Often they were talking about, like, if they led a group that day, you know, what was happening in the group and the dynamics. And I just remember this place. It was like the group, like, what is this mystical land that is the therapy group, you know? But it didn't matter that I didn't follow at all. It was just really fascinating. And and then, you know, as I got older, I could follow more and more. And my mom was especially interested in, I mean, my parents had sort of been more psychoanalytic, psychodynamic. But my mom got more interested in experiential in the 90s, early 90s maybe, and I started paying attention, and through the 90s kind of began learning more about emotion and the body. And so, you know, I mean, I knew from a very young age that I wanted to be a therapist.
So thanks for sharing that. It's so fascinating. So you're like the perfect, like, prototypical person that when people ask, like, if they grew up with therapists as parents, like, are they gonna be like more like messed up, or are they gonna be like super like emotionally aware and like really like amazing in terms
of
their...
either way.
Yeah.
I've seen it go either way, yes.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like that was like a part of their parenting? Like, you kind of knew, like, like, they're therapists, or was it always just like that was not like part of it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when I say it can go either way, you know, I mean, we can all be honest among friends that therapists usually go to therapy because become therapists because of some trauma or some difficulty or complexity in their childhood. So, you know, we're not above having issues.
Yes.
But then the other hand, because of the work, there's a chance to really work on those issues and kind of, and I was lucky because my parents, they had me a little later, and so they'd already done 8 years of 3 times a week, you know, analysis. And so I think that helped. It was like they had some stuff, you know, from their childhood stuff, not, you know, but they had worked on it. They were aware. And so I think I got the lucky end of the stick in terms of the version of therapist we would want to have as our parent, you know, that actually has done their inner work and could be more aware about psychology. And I think learning about it really explicitly was helpful for my development. Like, I wasn't the kid that was like, oh, I don't want to learn, like, don't therapize me. I think I was actually like, oh, no, this is useful to understand about, to even think of the mind as something that is understandable and worthy of curiosity and understanding and needs to be, like, actively engaged with rather than just happening in the background, which is, I think, how our culture, you know, tends to approach the mind. And most parenting tends to approach the mind as if it doesn't exist, which is odd. Actually.
Yeah, totally.
So I think it worked out well for me, but it can go either way.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. I think that's like when I discovered you by, way of YouTube. You know, you just like type in, I think I was looking up like IFS stuff, internal family systems, and one of your videos popped up. And like now it kind of makes sense to me because like the way that you talk about, like the way you're describing a certain philosophy or a certain technique or a concept, it seems like so natural. And the way you explain it's so natural and it comes off so like approachable.
Thank you.
And it's almost like if you're watching like a professional soccer player, like this person's been playing soccer since they were three, and like watching you, I was like, this is like a professional therapist. Like this person's been like in the therapy like world since they were, you know, three. So
it's a native language.
So like that's really what drew me to like your videos and your vibe was just this like such a natural gift to like share your knowledge in such a cool way.
Thank you so much. That means a lot.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Awesome. So yes, yeah, so you decided to become a therapist, and then you enter into the therapy world, and then there's like so many branches of like how what you're gonna specialize in, what your technique's gonna be. Like, could you kind of share your journey and how you kind of found like the niche that really worked for you, or like your style? Like that'd be kind of cool to hear.
You're right. It is very, it's sort of wild out there when you're a therapist trying to navigate, and grad school doesn't help that much with that navigation. I mean, again, I was lucky because in the 90s, early 90s, my mom started studying with this woman who's brilliant named Yvonne Agazarian, and she had invented a form of group therapy that was, I think it may be one of the only like really experiential but widely, you know, sophisticated group therapy model that I know of anyway. I shouldn't say that, but it wasn't content-based. It wasn't people telling stories about their life or their week or their marriages and then later in making interpretations about how they did it or anything. It was the members were all encouraged to simply share what they're feeling in the moment and how that's happening in their body, which is fascinating if that's the only thing people are sharing. No stories from outside. And then she had some really sophisticated ways of sort of helping that deepen, called subgrouping. But in other words, she would just have people really resonate with each other and explore shared emotions together at the same time. And I was like, so she was kind of a grandmother figure to me. She was around the house. She was this old British woman, kind of tough as nails, really analytic, really going to make you work for it, you know. And so she didn't let me do any training with her until I was at least out of high school, you know, because I could at least say I'm a psychology student at that point and not freak all the other therapists at the training out. But as soon as I was out of high school, my sister and I would start going to, you know, trainings where that's what we're doing. We're just sitting with other therapists and describing what's happening in our body in the moment, emotionally, you know, with eye contact the whole time. You also had to have eye contact the whole time. Mm-hmm. It was a really intense form of therapy. It's great training. If anyone wants to really explore how to be present and connected, it's called system-centered therapy, and it's hard to learn to be a system-centered therapist, but it's great training just to go to the weekends, you know, because then you're just doing 2 days of this kind of work with other people in the moment. It's really powerful. So that's Yvonne Agazarian's work. And I just thought, you know, I was like, wow, what it taught me was that emotions are beautiful. You know, the suffering that comes from emotions are not from the emotion themselves, but from our anxiety or shame and the defenses. Mm-hmm. Those are immediately, for most of us, immediately triggered when we have feelings. We either get anxious, we anticipate something bad, and so we're up in our head or we're fighting it or we're tense, and that's where the suffering comes. But when we can actually be joined and we're using mindfulness and we're slowing down and we're in our body, then anger, you know, can feel wonderful actually to tap into. It's enlivening, it's powerful. Sadness can be so meaningful if you have eye contact and you're really noticing the nuance of how it flows in your body, and it's very poignant, you know. You know, so there, I really, at an early age, I realized not to think in terms of negative and positive emotion. And that was wonderful training. My freshman year in college boyfriend, who now is my husband, I immediately pulled into it, and he thought it was the most wild thing because he did not have therapists for parents. And so, you know, I just started getting my friends involved in it. And then I was a modern dance major, which is also very embodied. And then I started meditating. I got on a spiritual path when I was about 20, and especially from 20 to 30 before having kids and I had time, I was really doing a lot of mindfulness. So late 90s, early 2000s. and had a spiritual teacher and all the things. And that also opened up the inner world for me a lot. And it, you know, when I went to grad school, which was after I'd started the spiritual path, it just kind of felt a little bit more like a hoop because, I mean, I learned a lot. I like my professors, but it was surface level, most of it. And so then I was drawn toward the end of grad school. There was beginning, mindfulness was beginning to be a word. Actually, not even during my grad school, just at the end, you know, mindfulness was beginning to come in. And then I immediately, then there was sort of an explosion, right, when I graduated, of ADP was one of the first ones I got trained in, you know, a little bit later, somatic experiencing. And and so I was just like, okay, that is similar to what I was raised with, which is an emotion focus. It's in the body. It's somatic. So I was just, you know, right, doing all the trainings I could do and all the experiential models, which mainly for me are just ADP, IFS, somatic experiencing, and coherence therapy, which people don't know as much about, but is also quite brilliant.
Yeah. What does ADP stand for?
Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. So it's one of the experiential dynamic psychotherapies. It's a type of psychodynamic. In other words, what are our conflicts around letting ourselves have our feelings and being in connection with others based on childhood wounds, you know? But the experiential dynamic movement, it was originally called short-term dynamic, but was using mindfulness, you know, getting in the body. What is it? What are you feeling right now? Undoing defenses. It was much more actively engaged, as most experiential therapies are. That's one of the things that makes experiential therapies unique, is the therapist is very actively engaged in coaching the process.
Okay.
Not just letting it be storytelling time, if that makes sense.
Mm. So if you like had to break down like what experiential therapy is defined as, or what it means, for someone who's never like heard about it, like how would you break that down for somebody?
So there's many types of experiential therapy, which I just made a whole long video about why, and it's a fascinating history. But the core similarities are wanting to track the unconscious mind rather than the explicit conscious personality and thoughts. And so it's very different than CBT in that way, because you're really trying to tap into the more deeper brain, you know, deeper imprints in the unconscious. So they all have that similarity. And they all use what's called bottom-up processing. But you could also call it mindfulness. It's, you know, in other words, we want to see what emerges in the moment from inside, from the deeper mind, versus top-down would be something like, okay, you're having some anxiety, so from your thinking, or from your conscious intent, let's try to regulate it. Mm-hmm. Top-down is like regulation work. Bottom-up is more discovery. It's more bumping into... I don't know. I think it's sort of like letting the deeper mind speak for itself. You know, asking questions that the intellectual mind can't answer. You know, like, what is that tension know? Or what are the tears trying to tell you? Or where does that live in your body? Like, how are you experiencing that right in your body right now? And can you just put a hand over that spot and be with it? And now see what comes. And now see what comes. They do a lot of what's called moment-by-moment tracking. Just see what comes next, you know? Let your mind... show itself to you. And there's two kind of key pieces to make that possible. I think of sort of like core ingredients. One is mindfulness, some kind of mindful awareness, something to open the space and make it feel safe. Well, I said mindfulness first. And the second, safety. Just making it feel safe, you know, non-judgment, curiosity, you know, I'm here with you, pacing the work, you know, using... resourcing if necessary to kind of help it go slow enough, help it be understood. I'm thinking, I know this is more psychedelic assisted therapy focus. I'm thinking of set and setting. I don't know a ton about it, but like things like set and setting would be an example.
For sure.
You know, just let's not just, you know, in the olden days, therapists would actually try to produce anxiety, or they would purposefully be sort of withholding. I don't know if tried, but they would purposely be a little bit withholding so that like, let's stir up the anxiety, you know. But actually, it works better if you can soften the anxiety. There will be still anxiety because you're taking risks, but let there be as little as possible so that the mind can stay integrated in a flow state and still speak instead of, you know, go into a fight or flight and stress response. It really makes it hard to explore from. So I think those are, sorry, I know that's a long answer, but those are, I think, the two core pieces is safety and mindfulness.
Amazing. Awesome. Yeah, so are you sure you're not a psychedelic therapist? Because everything that you've, like all of that is so true to psychedelic therapy. And
Yeah.
So the idea of allowing the unconscious to see what comes up. And so when I'm doing my sessions, like for when people do their first session with me, which is with ketamine, so it's ketamine assisted psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. The main intention that I tell people to bring into that first session is that of curiosity. In the psychedelic world, they call it like the beginner's mind. So yeah. Imagining that you've like never been to the zoo before and you see this giraffe and you're like, what the heck is that? Like, look at its neck and its long legs and the colors. And it's interesting with psychedelics, a lot of people will have like a specific intention. Like, I want to work on a relationship with my mom. And like you said, that's very like top down, right?
Yeah.
And the psychedelics are like, nope. Like, like it's a totally different thing that will come up for them. And so it's a lot of like coaching and preparation about like trusting the process and seeing what comes up naturally and then going with that, going with the flow.
Yes.
And then the other part that you talked about is something that I also prepare my patients with is listening to the body. And so we do a lot of meditation beforehand, a lot of educating about how one feels in the body when they're talking about something or noticing if they have a pause or change in affect, ask them about where they feel that in their body. Which is totally new for a lot of people. They're like, what are you, like, the body? Like, I don't
know. So, what do you mean? Yeah.
And then asking people to really, like, notice what's happening in their body, like, where it is, what shape this emotion has, if it has a color, does it vibrate? And then what I usually ask people is, like, notice what happens with that emotion, like, with the medicine on board. How it transforms, how it changes, does it stay the same? All the things that you've been talking about parallel.
Absolutely. It was funny because I was almost, as you were talking, I was like, oh, it's like experiential work on steroids. And I was like, well, it's not on steroids, but it is on something. It's like, it's expanded. It's even more intense, or it's like really opening, but it's the same frame still.
It's the same.
It is experiential work. It's just that before we had the medicine kind of, it's like, it was like we just had to use techniques and mindfulness. You can actually get there, of course.
Without intervention.
And so it's the same thing. It's just without the heightening of the help, you know, but it's the same core process. How can we open the mind to flow and actually for the conscious mind to sort of enter into the unconscious mind? Which is actually, I think it's a lot easier than we used to think to do that, actually. Mm-hmm. In the olden days, how I grew up, it was thinking of the unconscious mind as this very foreign, separate thing. And I think that was actually part and parcel of the technique being off. Because if you approach the unconscious mind in a sterile way with a blank screen therapist, it's non-responsive, with not a lot of coaching or direction, just let's free associate, you know, that's scary. And then when someone's scared or feels disconnected from or judged or just doesn't know how, isn't giving coaching, then it's a lot harder to go in than it can be with just some tweaks. So I think that's very exciting to me, is to realize like, oh, the deeper mind, actually, we can get even an uninitiated client, if given the right guidance, really like coached how to drop out of their head, coached how to be mindful and listen and slow down. The deeper mind actually wants to speak, I think, and can. It's not so difficult to get that information.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. And like you said, the psychedelics, like what I tell people is that the, you know, like right now it's very like hyped up and it's like all over the news, the media, like the term psychedelics, psychedelic therapy. Mm-hmm. And there's like a lot of focus on like the molecule itself, like the medicine itself. What I tell people is that like the therapy, like, is the medicine. Like the therapy is the same, and the molecule, like you were talking about before, like what it really does, it allows that window of tolerance to be widened, and so. Mm-hmm. You're not able to be like hypervigilant and you break through up top and you're too agitated so you can't engage in therapy, or the opposite, you have less of a constraint to freeze. And so people either will become agitated or they'll freeze. And so the psychedelics kind of open up that window, so you're able to play more in the therapy realm.
That's wonderful.
And so, like, that's really what it does. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it's the therapy that's the true medicine. And so, like, yeah, I think it's going to be exciting to see how that takes place. And I think people that approach therapy in the same mindset that you, like, it's like a duck on water. It's like the mesh is like right there. Do you have any interest in like doing work with psychedelics? Like, if it,
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just been so busy, and it's so new, and the training opportunity, you know, it's been a little bit, but yeah, I have lots of friends who are getting into it, and it's been on my radar for a number of years, you know, post COVID, mm-hmm. and you know, it's like, oh, I would love to one day, because I think it would be beautiful. Like you said, it would be really natural to facilitate those sessions, or even just afterward to process them and be in that role, or however that looks. I kind of assume I'll have some interlacing with it at some point.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, just the way you like talk about it, and just from watching your YouTube videos, I think it will naturally lend into the way that you work.
Yeah. Well, what I like about it, from the little that I've understood, is that what is being instilled is a deep trust in the mind.
Yep.
And I think that is so important and missing. Do you mind if I say a bit about that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, because this is, you know, this is really relates to psychedelic, but it's also just a meta point, a larger point. You know, I think one of the reasons we all struggle so much psychologically is because, both through traumas, whether they be attachment traumas or other kinds of traumas, you know, out in the world, and just from our culture and our training and what we kind of absorb, I think we learn to fear. We're at the very least, we learn to be alien from. But I think even deeper, we learn to fear and feel shame around our inner world, like our mind itself, you know. And this is kind of relationship to self stuff, but often that kind of phrasing might suggest just like, oh, we have an inner critic that's hard on us and we're not compassionate enough for ourselves, which is huge and a big deal. But I also think it's like our relationship to our mind, you know, to mental processes themselves, you know, feelings, knowings, like clarities. We can really learn, and I think most of us have learned, I mean, maybe especially from our parents, but it really could be anything, you know, racism and all sorts of, you know, gaslighting, and is it something we know or feel or perceive or maybe need? When we allowed ourselves to know that or feel that or be clear about that, it led to some negative outcome. You know, we were punished. We were told we were too much. We were told we were crazy. It shut down mom because she's scared of anger. And so she gets depressed. You know, it's like it led somewhere really scary in that. It led to disconnection. It led to rejection. It led to just being alone. But that's overwhelming for a kid. They're not supposed to be with feelings alone, even though the feeling's healthy. And so I think what is so hard for many of us is this thing we have, this like the best resource we possibly have, our own mind. You know, it's like, it's our best thing. We unconsciously, I don't think we're aware of it, we have some fear or shame laced into our associations of our own mental processes. And I think, and that's why I think that's my favorite part of like why I'm interested in psychedelic, is like, wow, like that the trust that's coached, at least that's my understanding. You can tell me if this is accurate, you know.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, just trust, just for a moment, just let your mind do its thing, you know, and just trust that it knows what it's doing and maybe can organize itself and isn't so crazy and isn't just chaos, but has a deeper order that will unfold if you let it for a moment without interrupting it or going to fear or shame. Am I getting that right?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So we call, it's called like the inner healing intelligence.
Yeah.
And so what we say is trust the healer within.
Yeah.
which really empowers someone with their own healing, mm-hmm. versus, modern medicine is more like people are like fix me from the outside. Like, give me something that's going to fix me because I can't trust what's going on in here because this is all messed up.
Yeah.
And psychedelics, like, totally puts that on its head and says, no, no. Yeah. Like, the true healing potential is within you.
Yes.
And it's always been there.
Yes.
And it's just time to, like, discover it.
Yes, it's always there.
It's always there. But having psychedelics on board, especially with MDMA and trauma, it really allows one to bathe in so much self-love.
Yes.
That, like, when you are trying to discover within, there's this, like you said, there's a safety that you're cradled in through the experience that allows you to be vulnerable but feel very safe the entire time.
That is so
And then allows access to that, like, inner healer, that self-energy in such a beautiful way.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. I'm very hopeful about it. I think it's so stunning to have all the helps we can get from, you know, the molecule to the therapist, you know, learning new, you know, to be more present. You know, it's like, I feel it. And just getting information about it out there, the idea itself that we have an inner healer, we have a mind that is beautiful and resilient and knows what it's doing if given a chance. And then just understanding, okay, well, why does that get blocked day to day? And maybe we can talk about that for a moment, because even though the inner healer is there, that doesn't mean we've ever experienced that. And I think it comes back to what I was just mentioning, where unfortunately, when we're children and trying to, like, access our inner flow state where, you know, we have a feeling and then we reach for mom and dad, because we're dependent on mom and dad or whatever caretaker to be there to, we can't really quite do it on our own yet as a child. If that doesn't happen or it goes somewhere negatively, as actually all trauma and it could be included in this, there's some way that we actually can want to turn away from our own mental processes so that we never actually get to see where they're going to take us. And the way that gets stored, probably mainly in the subcortical brain, although, you know, we'll see. But the main, you know, is what I think of the unconscious mind is just, you know, in neural networks that make that imprint, make that association. You know, if I associate, let's say, a sadness with some negative outcome, and those kind of patterns, those kind of mapping of reality and what to expect and how to respond, you know, that's literally like neural links being made, you know. I guess the neuroscientists call that a long-term potentiation pattern. Like, that's the way our brain's going to fire now, such that when that feeling or that need or that knowing, you know, begins to kind of come online, like, it's just tied into, oh, this is bad, and now I have to do this instead. Yeah. And I think of it as like little, how I imagine it is like little neural tangles. You know, like, it's like a little tangle in the unconscious mind where things got tangled together that actually don't belong together. Mm. Like, something healthy got tangled with associations of danger or being bad, you know, shame, in other words. So it's like, that's where we get in trouble. When something healthy got tangled up with negative associations of shame or danger, and then with some kind of defense.
Yeah.
I criticize myself. I shut down. I put up a wall. I go drink. Now I have to do this. If this is dangerous, now I have to do this to manage it, this other thing. And it's like a little path through the woods. It's like, it just gets all tied together so that as soon as we're having the healthy thing, oh, nope, we go over here instead.
And that can kind of be like a birth of a schema.
It's a schema. Like, yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So some people call them schemas, emotional learnings, mental models, you know, core belief or unconscious belief, you know. But it's like and it's unconscious. It's almost strange to call it a belief because it's unconscious. It's more like a little pathway of neural firing, you know, that just gets set up. And then before we know it, we're having the drink, but we don't even know why. You know, it's not because we consciously believe that it's dangerous to be alone, so I have to go get the drink. But you could call it a belief because it's a map of reality that we hold unconsciously so that we can respond without thinking. And those maps are, those tangles are what get in the way of our inner healer, you know, get in the way of just being able to naturally, you know, process through a grief or have our anger and let it, you know, move through and just process it or allow ourselves to be clear about something that we need clarity on, you know, because we're like, no, you're not supposed to know that. That's too difficult if you know, let yourself know that. Okay, well, dang, you know. So I think this, I'm just pulling in here a little bit because I figure we might want to talk about memory reconsolidation at some point, but that this is a very physical thing. It's like, these are tied together. And that's kind of what we want to have a chance in therapy, whether, you know, talk therapy or psychedelic, or is to kind of like reopen and bump into and sort of like find those places that are like, oh, you think you have to go here? You think that's bad to have this, you know, and just look at it fresh so the mind can say, wait, is that really true? Do I need to have that? Is that a foregone conclusion that, anger is shameful and I need to do this and that? It's like to open that space again to kind of like, oh, can we update those inner realities and inner maps?
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's a great segue to memory reconsolidation. For people that don't know like what that means or what that entails, you kind of really just described it right now, but would it be cool if you broke it down a little bit more simply so that people understand like why that concept's so cool and why, I think you said this in one of your videos, like why you believe that this is going to change therapy in such a cool way moving forward.
Yeah. So, you know, the goal has always been to change the unconscious mind and these early, these are like imprints that live in implicit memory. But for a long time, neuroscientists, as we started, studying the brain, didn't really think it was possible to change implicit memory. For instance, fear conditioning, that would be it. When I'm talking about one of these tangles, it's really kind of like fear conditioning, right? It's like we became phobic of something healthy, right? But through experience. And, you know, neuroscientists thought, well, you can override, you can do extinction, you can do another, you can learn something else and have a different neural network set up that's preferred, but it doesn't ever like, dissolve or deal with the original imprint of fear, for instance. But in the early 2000s, they began realizing through really starting off with, mice in the lab and then through to humans, that it is possible actually to open the original network, the schema, what I was referring to as the tangle, the long-term potentiation pattern, the original network. It is possible to open that network, those associations, for new learning. So they could take in new information that changes it in some key way or even dissolves the whole pattern entirely. So I won't go into sort of the how they discovered that. And but basically the bottom line piece, especially for humans, we'll talk in the more clinical, there's ways to do it with medicine or with drugs. But in terms of the actual therapy, like what needs to happen experientially, for the brain to open into what's called a labile state, that means it's the kind of proteins that hold those little neural links together can unlock. So for it to open into a labile state, it needs to have two things happening at once. One, it needs to be actively making a prediction, like if I'm angry, I'll rage like my rageaholic father and it'll be dangerous. You know, like feel the original prediction, feel the original knowing sort of has to be activated, not just intellectualized about, but kind of bumped into, like felt, while at the same time witnessing some other information that what's called disconfirms the prediction. It's called a mismatch. My brain is actively predicting one thing while actively seeing something else that proves that that prediction can't be true. So in the research, they call that the mismatch. And that moment of mismatch is what begins to unlock those neural networks for new learning. So it's really important in the therapy world, especially in coherence therapy, which is really designed with this in mind. The man, Bruce Ecker, who invented coherence therapy, is the first person that really started really diving into the memory reconsolidation research and thinking about it and how to make a therapy kind of, or how to align therapy, our therapy aims for that mission. But he calls that the juxtaposition experience. It's like we're really feeling, gosh, I really think this is true, while at the same time seeing some other truth. That it's a juxtaposition. And that is a wonderful moment. And what's exciting is that moment can be facilitated in a million ways. And it's not owned by any form of therapy. And all the experiential therapies do something to set that up, even if not intentionally, because we didn't have the science when these therapies were invented. But the reason that they sort of fell into understanding that we need access to the part of us, like if you want to use parts language, like see the part, feel the part, relate to the part that knows that I'm bad, or while feeling the adult part that knows something different, no, you're good, and can see it in another way. Hold those at the same time. Bring them into relationship. So there's many, you know, all the different therapies. Somatic experiencing did it more through like feeling the freeze state that says I can't move when I'm frozen, and then have some empowered action, you know, to disconfirm it. So there's many different ways of kind of getting there, but which is really cool, I think. But the bottom line is that it's have that, I think it was like surprising the unconscious mind. I was so sure of this, and I'm seeing is this other thing.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's so interesting how, and I think this is why there's such a fascination with psychedelics. Even when people, you know, for centuries have like taken them like in a non-therapeutic setting, they come back and they'll be like, that was so therapeutic because of this. Because for, like with the psychedelics, it allows you to naturally go through these steps. So you naturally like are met with something like scary from your past.
Yeah.
But with the help of the psychedelics, there's this different viewpoint that comes in. And you're like, wait a second. Like, oh, that's interesting. Like, maybe I'm not, maybe this doesn't define me as I thought it would.
Yes.
Maybe there's a different way to approach this that I never thought I was able to. And so the psychedelics like allow that, it allows that moment, like you said, to be more malleable.
Yeah.
And there's more like neuroplasticity that can happen in the moment. So like you said, it's just being able to do that on steroids.
Exactly. Yeah. So in my understanding correctly, like I think what I'm hearing you say is like with the use of the medicine, the original learning is more conscious. Like you can go in and you bump into those places of fear. That's an early learning. I'm bad, or if I do this, it's bad, or that connection is scary, or whatever meaning, the early meaning, it like, for one, allows that to be alive more on the one hand. So that's kind of step A, but also allows for a new perspective because you're not married to the old, you know, you're kind of in this observing kind of fluid creative space where you can see something new, which brings on the new knowing, right? So it kind of allows you to have both more access to the old knowing and have a new knowing at the same time.
Correct. Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
So for example, with some of the MDMA work that I've done through the clinical trials, you know, someone will be with the medicine, with the MDMA, and we encourage them to, it's just called like go inside. Yeah. So they have the headphones and the eye shades. And beforehand, we've had, you know, three preparation sessions where they're explicitly talking about like their traumas or what may come up for them. Yeah. But it's really interesting to see what happens when they go inside. Yeah. And, you know, they'll be quiet for sometimes 40 minutes, an hour and a half. And we have no idea what's going on in there. And then all of a sudden, like, they'll come out and they'll relay, like, exactly what we're talking about, how they were taken into like a place that was really scary, and there was like some sort of representation of like a trauma, this monster figure, and that it had like a certain message for them that was tied to the past of how they used to like do things, or how they used to define themselves, instead they like face this like dark figure, and they get to know it better, and they like really understand that it was like they're able to like have compassion in that moment for like what that like represents for them, and then they bring that to the present moment with the feeling and the medicine, and they're able to and it's really like interesting how like it naturally will be like the person like holding their younger self or talking to their younger self in a way that brings them to the present moment and like tells them that that they're not alone anymore.
That's so beautiful. I was just, as you were saying hold the present self, I was thinking, I think there's many, many types of schemas we can have, but I think one of the core schemas that many of us have, especially if there's attachment pieces, is I'm fundamentally alone.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So what a beautiful disconfirmation of that is you never have to be alone again. You're with yourself. You have yourself now in a way you can, of course, when you're a child, but now you can
be
in a deep, meaningful relationship with yourself. Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for explaining that. And like you said, it's cool to see how so many modalities take this concept and are creative with it in their own way. Yeah. You know, it's like EMDR, basically does this and it's very explicit. And many different other concepts, but it's cool how at its core they're all doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's really cool how psychedelics basically just do it on its own without any prompt.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah,
super amazing. Yeah. Let's see. So sometimes I'll ask people, and some people that I have on the podcast, they'll share a story with a psychedelic experience. That's totally up to you, whatever your comfort level is, or I'll ask if you would share a serendipitous story that is psychedelic in its own way without obviously taking any psychedelics. So maybe it's an experience in nature or something that made you realize that there's a lot more to what we only our eyes can see. And so I just wanted to see if there's anything there that you'd be willing to share and see what comes up for you.
So what comes up for me when I think about the mystery, I guess I'll call it the mystery.
Yeah, love it.
You know, it does go back for me to my earlier spiritual training. I was studying a lot of Sufism.
Okay.
And so it's like mysticism, basically.
Yeah.
And I was always drawn to the inner world. So when I found, mystics, it was like, people that just want to sit around and explore the inner world all day and be quiet, and embracing pain in a way, embracing discomfort, not just avoiding it, but just sitting with it, letting it see what happens, what you learn.
Yeah.
And there was a particular practice. So when I was, before my senior year in college, I was about 20, I did a 6-week spiritual retreat that I, continued doing throughout, every year, some version of it, but that was my first one. And I would get up one of the practices. What we would do is transcribe these ancient spiritual teachings all day. We'd write a page out and then meditate for an hour and then write another page. And maybe we'd do a little gardening or something. But then in the middle of the night, we're encouraged to, get up for, just an hour of meditation that's in the middle of the night. There's something actually very special about the middle of the night. Kind of reminds me actually of the darkness and the, when you put on the shades and the quiet and all that. But the middle of the night, especially I would love going outside and just kind of, there's a little pond and I could sit at night and watch the moon and so quiet. There really is a quiet in the middle of the night. And just sit, and it started off being an hour, which is kind of the normal, but then most nights by then I had sort of done I'd found the pain, I'd done the sort of process, I'd found the fear place, I'd meditated and chanted into it, and asked for divine perspective kind of and connected and had some healing experience. And then it would feel so good that I would do a second hour and third hour and fourth hour. So I ended up doing most nights 4 hours just in the middle of the night. And I always remember that space and the time and the learning, just what it felt like, how just watching the moon, move across the sky and being inward and just total permission to be inward. What a just amazing thing that is. And for sure relates to our whole conversation about, how most of us don't get initiated into any kind of spiritual practice or therapy space where that's even possible, but it's such a gift when it can be. I actually have a lot of grief for when people never have any, just are doing their job and going out to the bar and, it's such a missing, the magic, the mystery, it's just unbelievably beautiful. So that was kind of my inner version before I was thinking experiential therapy and memory reconsolidation, but that was what was happening. It's really moving internally, just giving total permission. Who wants, what part of my heart needs attention? I'll meet anybody who wants to come. Is it a Saturn or child? Is it a jealousy? Is it a, and allowing that to emerge and then just being met with love and I was connecting to God, you know, because it was really, you know, spiritual, and just feeling that light and energy, and then looking at it from another perspective, like, okay, divine universe, like, what do you know about this? Doing some chanting, and then just some other knowing would come. You know, just amazing, you know. That was exactly the medicine, exactly the thing my heart needed. So I think I source from that and drink from that, and sort of like that sustains me a lot, even as I don't have time to do that now that I'm a mom as much. But I'm glad I know about that. I'm glad that I've had that experience.
Wow, that's so beautiful. It's almost like it just like your story just kind of resonates with me, and that a lot of people get caught up in the idea that that psychedelics like are the only way to experience what you just said. And I think it's, you know, everyone has like their own path and own journey, and for a lot of people, like you said, they're stuck in this life of never being in touch with the magic. Yeah. Or not. Or maybe they grew up in a family where
there was no magic.
There was no magic, no spirituality. Everything was very, like, reality based. Going to the bars and work and, and so for them, like having like a psychedelic experience, like allows them to be like, wait a second, shit, like, there's magic here, and then from there, they begin to look at ways to explore magic without psychedelics. So meditation, spiritual practice.
Wow. If I could just piggyback on what you're saying a second, it's almost like we talked about the core schema of aloneness being undone, but like it's sort of a peripheral one, but maybe is also really important, which is this core understanding of reality, which is this is all there is to reality. And there is no magic, and it's just the physical and, you know, all that. And that for many people, maybe that's disconfirmed, that there's a mismatch, you know, they have a different thing that challenges it, that disconfirms it. So now that opens a lot of possibility, a lot of hope, curiosity to then find that magic, you know, or that aliveness, that richness that the unconscious mind has, the deeper mind, in their, you know, waking life.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think it's cool how you, like, came from the other end where you, which is, I guess, like I said, everyone's journey is different, but in a way it's more ideal because, that's how we really used to be. Yeah. We used to be so much more in touch with nature. Yeah. We used to be able to like sit and, explore our thoughts in a way that didn't have to do with, working at our desks or getting all these things done. Our mind is a psychedelic machine.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't need, it's just plain psychedelic.
So, it just needs the right, set and setting in order for it to manifest.
That's right.
But yeah, thanks for sharing that with me. That was awesome.
Oh yeah. You're welcome.
So I usually finish the podcast by asking everyone these same little series of questions. But I wanted to make sure there wasn't anything beforehand that you wanted to make sure we touched upon, or something that we didn't talk about that you feel is important to say.
No, I feel really complete. That was wonderful.
Okay, awesome, Tori. All right, so are you ready for the questions?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first question is, what is your favorite sound?
Well, this will not be a surprise, but silence.
All right.
I do love silence.
Love it. What is your least favorite sound?
You know, I'm not averse to any sounds, I don't think particularly, but I'm definitely not someone who wants like the TV on in the background. You know, anything that interrupts silence. Like if it's sound, I want it to be purposeful because I'm sitting down to listen to music and then I'm immersed in it. I don't even necessarily want music on in the background, you know? It's like either really listening to sound or quiet.
Okay, so the intention there is important.
Background sounds, yeah.
If you could hang out with someone for an entire day, just chill with them and you know, have breakfast, dinner, and hang out, anyone from human history, like who would that be and why?
Yeah. You know, who comes to mind is this early Sufi mystic from like the 700s, named Rabia. And I think she just fascinates me. Like, it would be fascinating, especially if I could really go back in time. I mean, that'd be amazing in a million ways. Like, what was What was her life like as this sort of mystic that just lived very, very simply in like a, you know, a hut with nothing? You know, she's a very intense mystic. But she was kind of famous in the Sufi tradition as being like the only person who achieved enlightenment, so to speak, without the help of a teacher. So just based on her pure passion. Wow. She's kind of known as this person that just would not give up, just total passion, could care less about the external world, like didn't want any social, you know, comforts. She just cared about God, is how she would, you know. And I think that kind of with her passion and her, I don't know, just like commitment and strength and wildness, I think would be really neat to just observe her for a day.
Oh man, I love that answer. That's awesome. All right. And the next questions are, finish these sentences. The best part of being alive is?
Well, you know, since we just had that conversation, I think I can finish it by saying it is the mystery.
All right. I love that. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then the last question, or the last sentence to finish is, let's party like it's.
I mean, I have to say 1999. I just can't change it because
it's a great year. It's a beautiful year.
It's okay. Well, because it was the year that I really did start going to all these trainings and, you know, launching off, you know. So it was, it was the year I did my first, you know, motion focus, experiential training, all that stuff. And so it was a beautiful decade to follow for me of exploration.
Yeah. Oh, 99. Oh, wonderful. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Tori, thank you so much for spending this last hour with me. Yeah, I just have so much gratitude to you. And like you said, like with your Rabia is her name?
Rabia, yeah.
For me, like you're one of my teachers. Been following you on YouTube for the last couple of years, and I have so much gratitude towards you and for helping me along my way and being one of my teachers. And so it's been so awesome spending time with you.
Oh, that's so wonderful. It's been so wonderful to meet you and spend time with you as well.
Awesome, Tori. Where can people find your work? I'll obviously put some links on the show, but for people listening, like where can they find you?
Yeah, you know, probably on YouTube is the easiest and cheap. Free is free. You know, I do have CEU for most licenses, depends, but I do offer CEU's online trainings. I have a bunch, including ethics, on my website too, toriolds.com. I do offer a 6-month training group and sort of the basics of experiential therapy. That's just like a weekly Zoom training group. So people could email me about that as well if they wanted, toriolds@gmail.com. Yeah.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much for checking out my conversation with Dr. Tori Olds. So I'll leave some links to her website and her YouTube channel in the episode description, so you can check out her work. She's amazing. And again, so much gratitude to her for coming on the podcast and having a conversation with me. And I hope everyone has a beautiful day out there, and I'll see you on the next podcast.